This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear debris with the 40-volt jet fan leaf blower. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, and welcome to the BBC Gardeners World magazine podcast, brought to you by the team here at the magazine. Join us as we chat all things gardening with the nation's favourite experts.
Many of us realise the importance of gardening for wildlife, from growing flowers for pollinators to providing nesting habitats for birds and hedgehogs. There's a range of things we can do in our gardens to help wild species. But is there more we can do? And what potential is there really to help reduce or even reverse declines of wild populations? Hello, I'm Kate. And in today's episode, we hear from Fergus Garrett, head gardener at the wonderful Great Dixter, which is absolutely teeming with wildlife. You'll hear why Great Dixter is such a fantastic habitat for so many species, how Garrett and his team of gardeners work with wildlife, and the specific habitats they've created to help even more species.
So we're at Great Dixter. That's me, Kate Bradbury, with Fergus Garrett, head gardener of the amazing Great Dixter Gardens in Rye in East Sussex. It's mid-August, it's raining. The sky is quite grey, but it's still amazingly beautiful and colourful. And so we're here in the barn garden, and in front of us is a hexagonal pond. And I think you've got great crested newts in there.
Yes, we have. Yes, it's a really high concentration of great crested newts. Because if you look around, Kate, I mean, there's all those walls that they can go into as well. I mean, it's a rich habitat, isn't it? Really.
Yeah, so the ponds, the hexagonal pond is surrounded by paving, lovely stone slates with walls, and you've got loads of stuff growing out of the walls. You've got lots of Mexican fleabane there and bits of geranium and fern. So loads of little spaces for the great crested newts to sort of hang out in, really.
Yeah, I mean, the whole space works really, really well. It's all very rich. Because, you know, we're looking at that magnificent building that sits right in the middle of the garden. It's a 15th century building with a Lutyens wing added to it. And if you look at that, there's all sorts of nooks and crannies where things can sort of nest and make a home for themselves. And their feeding place is this garden, which is just prolific in flowers.
And that's the thing about Great Dixter, isn't it? It's a beautiful garden, but together with the work that you've done, the work that came before you with Christopher Lloyd, and the amazing surroundings you've got, Great Dixter is known for its incredible wildlife value.
Yeah, I think the recent biodiversity audit that we did that took over a year and a half. Funded by the National Lottery. I mean, they've been sort of incredible in supporting this bit of work. But it showed that the garden is extraordinarily rich. You know, I've been gardening for many, many years now, and I went to university to study it and so on. And I was always told that in order to have a wildlife garden, you have to concentrate on natives and you have to do this and you have to do that and so on. And of course, there's an element of truth in all of that. So you didn't expect a garden like Dixter that's so intensive and colourful. You know, we garden it, you know, we pull it apart and garden it. You didn't expect something like that to have a high wildlife value. In fact, you know, when I've spoken at various conferences always had a sort of a certain coolness from ecologists that have think, well, you're a gardener, so because you're manipulating nature, you know, you're part of the problem. Whereas now, with these sort of studies, and of course the extraordinary study that Jennifer Owen did in her Leicestershire garden, you know, and
where she wrote a book, didn't she, about her garden over 30-year period?
Right. Yes, and she found over, I think she has something like 750 meters square of garden, and she found over 2,600 species in there, and over that 30-year period. So it just, and her garden wasn't a bramble patch, or it wasn't a nettle patch. It was ornamental. She did certain things that you know, she pruned less, she allowed more detritus and so on. She was sort of messy around the edges, as we are. But it was just a safe haven for all those insects. So, you know, it shows that gardens have a value, and ornamental planting can have a value as long as you do a number of things, or don't do a number of things. One of them, spray the living daylights out of your garden, and of course, you know, if you grow a high percentage of double flowers that haven't got that source for bees and pollinators, then, you know, your wildlife value will go down. But you can still, you know, you can mix it all up and still be effective in terms of harbouring biodiversity. And that's what the study at Dixter has shown, which means that the systems of a garden can be applied to any small garden or any large garden or any sort of designed landscape, that it can always have a positive effect on biodiversity. If you break it down, why is Great Dixter rich? Because when we did the study all those years ago, I was expecting the woodlands to be rich and the meadowlands and the pasture land to be rich and all of that. But the garden was the richest part of all. And the reason for that is because there's diversity here. You know, there's water, there are dry areas, there are wet areas, there are shady areas, there are sunny areas, there are nooks and crannies in wood, there's rotting wood, there's, you know, holes in the tiles, etc., all of that, all in one garden. Now, in a town, all those different, that diversity will come from a number of gardens, you know, and it will all add up to something quite significant. So it's really exciting, isn't it? It means that we can all play a part in this.
We can all play a part in this, definitely. So tell us about the study then that we conducted all those years ago, because that's what started this off for you, wasn't it, Fergus?
That's right, yeah. I always thought that Dixter was rich because Christopher Lloyd, who was born here and gardened here all his life, and the Lloyd family, they're very sympathetic to the landscape and to the way they garden. They liked, you know, they allowed an element of Mother Nature to come into the garden. So hence we got the meadows that come into the, and which isn't everybody's cup of tea, because some people think, oh, they look messy, but we don't, you know, it's just glorious with orchids and so on in those long grass areas. So, and Christo had a part of his brain open to all of this. He admired the great crested newts. He always was excited when he saw slow worms or grass snakes, and he would go out at night and look for moths and look at butterflies and so on, and we'd always be excited whenever we saw a woodpecker and so on. So, you know, we weren't detached from it. So I always thought Dixter is rich, but I thought that was it, you know, that's as much as we need to do. But my dear wife, who's a ecologist, zoologist, said to me, you really ought to look at the whole picture, because you're only doing ad hoc studies on butterflies and so on. Why don't you look at everything so that you know what's there? And look at not just the insects or the pretty little things, study the lichens and the bryophytes and the mushrooms and the whole lot, because there's this thing called the web of life. It all interlinks and so on. And so it'll give you a really good idea of what's here, so that if you need to then act and change the management of anything, you know how you're affecting the whole system here. Because before then, what we were doing, Kate, was that we were thinking, oh, we want to create a wildlife bit, so we just created another meadow. You know, just thinking that because 90-odd% of meadows had been lost in the country since the Second World War, let's put another meadow and pat ourselves on the back and that's job done. You know, that sort of thing. And Amanda would say, well, why create another meadow? Do you need another meadow? Haven't you got enough meadows? Is there another habitat you should be creating? You don't even know what's rare around you that you could be supporting or should be supporting or what you should be increasing. So have a slightly more intelligent approach to this so that you can just pick and choose how you go about managing it. So, and I thought, well, great. So I went to the Heritage Lottery and they funded all these specialists to come in and to look at everything from mosses, liverworts, to moths, butterflies, to dragonflies, to beetles, to wasps, etc. All the whole lot we looked at. And it was a one-year study of these specialists coming in and looking at the whole estate from the woodlands right the way through to the garden and the buildings. And then the results came out and the results were just extraordinary. You know, in fact, our lead ecologist, Andy Phillips, said that really Great Dixter should be designated a local wildlife site or a local wildlife reserve. He said it's so rich, it's one of the richest places that he's surveyed, and because it's complex and it's diverse, and in fact it's changed the way he's looked at gardens, because he you know, part of him regarded gardens as being quite sterile. Because they can be, can't they? Because they get the living daylight sprayed out of them and everything's sort of tidied up and so on. So and now he comes into here and says, this is what I call a garden, and it's just dripping with all sorts of interesting things. And there are massive benefits of that. There are massive holistic benefits for us, because we know we're sharing the space with life, you know, that it's not just a sterile picture that we're looking at. It's not just about colour. It's about life within this garden. So that goes deep down in all of us and does something to you as a gardener. But also the benefits of this is that because we're not spraying all the insects or anything, we stopped spraying all those years ago, we find that we've got enough predators to feed off the pests. So we don't even have to, you know, have to worry about, oh, what are we going to do with the aphids? And what are we going to do with this? Because we know that there's some sort of a balance there. And it's not always perfect, because slugs will eat our dahlias and so on and all those sort of things. And we try and do the best we can by putting wool around it or so on. And but, you know, so certain things get hit. But on the whole, we can create a beautiful, aesthetic, colourful, dynamic garden like this and still have all that life with it as well.
That's the beauty of wildlife gardening, isn't it? Like, once you've got that ecosystem in place, everything sort of looks after itself. And it just makes it easier and just also just gives you more time to just sit and enjoy it, really.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Kate. I mean, it doesn't sort of happen overnight, does it? You have to sort of hold your nerve for a bit. And there are sort of imbalances out there all the time. But it sort of looks after itself. But you sort of tend to be slightly more relaxed about things as well. And, you know, it's just enjoying the whole sort of the whole microcosm of life that shares that space with you, and also it makes that journey from A to B so much more interesting, because you're not just thinking oh, there's another little fly. Well, that little fly is one of the 270 solitary bees that exists in the UK and so on, and it's probably got something attached to its backside that is taken down into a, you know, little hole in the ground, you know, and all of that. So it's just it's just fascinating, the life with each of these things. And setting a moth trap, for instance, you know, we're in the garden during the day, and of course we do visit at night and we're part of it at night, but when you set a moth trap and where they come to the light.
So yeah, a moth trap is a box essentially with a very high powered light, isn't it? And that, yeah, that the light attracts the moths and then they fall into the box, and it's all very safe, and you leave little egg boxes in the box for the moths to shelter under there, and they spend the night there, and then you look at them in the morning with glee and then set them free. So it's not a sort of trap as such for those worried that we're catching moths. It's,
no,
it's a means to look at the moths and monitor the moths and then set them on their way. But yes.
And we're very careful that we don't do it too often. And because also what happens is that the hornets and the birds get accustomed to the moth, mm-hmm, moth trap, and they go in there and eat the moths. So we just do it now and again to see what's out there. And the moths are released under bushes and things later on in the morning. We try and get there really early morning, but it gives you an account of what's flying around. And you know, suddenly you come to this box that's been set overnight and you go into and look at these egg cartons and there's hundreds of really extraordinarily camouflaged, colourful things with the most amazing names as well attached to them. And it just shows you, you just think, wow, all this stuff is flying around at night and I'm not even aware of it, you know. Yeah, it's a really brilliant feeling. But the main thing is that you can create a colourful ornamental garden that has exotic plants in it and non-native plants in it that rub shoulders with natives and which will support biodiversity. So gardeners can play their part, you know. That doesn't mean we start going out into sort of the wild land beyond the garden and start planting it with exotics. We're not doing that, but it just it gives you a feeling that you don't need to be ashamed to be a gardener in order to have, you know, support life. And I think the most important thing is that you gain a bit of knowledge, you know, because there are sort of things that we think are good when they're not good, you know, all the time.
Yeah. Should we go and have a look at the gardens?
Yep.
Where should we go first?
Shall we go to the Long Border?
Yes.
Yeah, let's go to the Long Border.
Lovely.
And it's not a straightforward thing, this, is it, really? Because if you look at honeybees, for instance, everybody who's, you know, people make a beeline for honeybees and say, we're going to create a wildlife garden and in that we need pollinators and so we're going to put a beehive. Well, it's not as straightforward as that because a lot of these bees used in honey production are non-native. And also they are aggressive and very efficient in the way that they harvest the pollen, so they can squeeze out some of the solitary bees that belong to the area. As well as that, they're very inefficient in the way that they pollinate because they sort of wrap the pollen up in this sort of, I don't know, this slime and stick it to their legs rather than collecting dry pollen. So they're not as effective as pollinators as much.
They don't drop as much on the flowers,
yeah,
do they?
Yeah, so you know, but everybody makes a beeline for, sorry the pun, a beeline for honeybees to be the pollinators, whereas it's not necessarily the case. So,
well, a lot of people don't realise. I mean, honeybees, they get awful lot of media attention, And what a lot of people don't realise is that, you know, there's 270 species of bee in the British Isles, and one of them is the honeybee. We've got 24 bumblebees, and the rest are solitary bees. So the diversity of bees is so much greater than the honeybee alone. And I love honeybees, but I just find so many more.
Sure.
You know, interesting in my garden.
Yeah, I think it's that it's the thing is diversity, you know, having that sort of...
aim is to just get as many bees as possible using your space. Well, that's my aim anyway.
Yeah, so, and for us, we're a big garden, we're 6 acres, so we can have a lot of diversity, but I think you can still have diversity in a small garden. I mean, a little bit of water helps, doesn't it, for things to, you know, a little bit of detritus helps, and maybe a rotting log stack tucked away around the back, you know, would help. Not cutting down everything at once helps, doesn't it? And when you're creating walls or whatever, making sure that there are little holes and nooks and crannies for things to go and build a home in. That's important as well. And of course, there are things out there that the people can get that are insect hotels, for instance, that they can get from a garden centre, or you can buy nesting boxes or specific for you know, swift boxes, for instance, and you can even buy bricks that can be put into a wall that are good for insects and so on. They've got the specific holes in them, or you can just drill holes in something to allow sort of nesting sites. So with a little bit of info, we can actually do so much more, so that every space counts in all of this. And I mean, we're just walking past a muddy bit here where the grass has been worn.
And there's a beautiful blackbird there eating your mulberries.
That's right. And look at the trunk of the mulberry trees. I mean, it's just lots of little nooks and crannies for things to nest in there. But, you know, we don't even repair some of the paths. We don't re-turf these areas because we find that this compact ground is really good for some of the mining bees that go into them, you know.
So this is the beautiful long border, and I can see lots of daylilies, I can see canna lilies, I can see cardoons, salvias, veronica, dahlias. There's so much here. Fennel, so much fennel. It's beautiful. So tell us about the long border, Fergus.
Well, it's a mixed border, so it's all backed by a hedge, but it's got trees and shrubs and perennials and annuals and self-sowing biennials and climbers all mixed in together, and it's rich in flowers, as you can see here. You know, it's from all the color that you see in this wet August day to the stuff that if you came here in February, there'll be hellebores and snowdrops in flower. Then if you came here in March, there'll be early daffodils and something else in flower. And then you go to forget-me-nots and alliums and all those sort of things, and the gladioli come and all the spring flowers and so on. So there's flush after flush after flush of plants that come and so there's a long season of flower. And if you came here in October, there'll still be things in flower. So that is important because it just means that there's a long season of food source in here. And as well as that, the structures are so different. You know, they've got the shrubs that things can nest into and so on. And there's element also important, I think, is that there's an element of disturbance in there, because maybe I would say about a tenth of the border is dug up twice a year to change over the bedding, and we grow the stuff ourselves. You know, we sow the seed or take cuttings and pot it on and plant it out, and when we take it out and it's finished, we then compost it, and that compost goes into that sort of the cycle of compost that we use through the garden. So it's a very nice sort of closed circuit there. But the disturbance, the trauma and disturbance is also important, because that open ground, so it's all about being, you know, dynamic and open, because I think you can have the best habitat, but if you don't have that dynamic disturbance element to it, then the biodiversity will plateau out. So you need change. And that's why it was good in the old landscape when you had large herbivores that were disturbing the ground and so on. And that's why it's good when a cliff collapses and then you've got a bare ground that's opened up so that things can go and nest in there and so on. So that element of disturbing, which is the act of gardening, is a positive thing as well, rather than something that's settled and closed. And so we garden this for a long season. We garden it for it to be a magnificent, colourful display. There are sort of wildish plants in there, including wild native plants like cow parsley and so on, but it has a very informal feel to it. And then it's got a path next to it and short grass, and the meadows are right next to that. And then the meadows then go away to scrub and then to woodland. So it's all within, all that diversity is within close proximity to one another. So it's a very rich border visually, and it's rich for biodiversity.
So tell us about the meadows then, Fergus, because we're standing here and, you know, as you say, we've got this beautiful ornamental border on the left. We've got a path, we've got a little bit of short grass here, and then it just goes into this amazing meadow for almost as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, they're really terrific, the meadows at Dixter. Incidentally, you know, we've seen a few sort of yellow vetches here, and we've got the long hornbee at Dixter, which is feeding off these, which is, you know, it's not a sort of common thing at all.
Not on a day like today, sadly.
But actually, the interesting thing is that it's not just on the meadow, but it was spotted feeding on the long border, on a Lathyrus grandiflorus on the long border as well. So, you know, things do cross over to non-native stuff. But the meadows, I think, you know, they were throughout the countryside around us, these long grass areas, but they were hay meadows. And so many of them have been lost, although new ones have been created as well, because farming has intensified and, you know, people use more silage, etc., all of that, and some other sort of with the sprays that have come in as well. So we've sort of lost that habitat. And what that habitat provided was this long period of flowers for all those insects that were, and the mammals and everything else. So with us, within the garden, they're slightly more ornamental than the long grass areas outside the garden. The season starts with snowdrops and crocuses, and then goes on to daffodils, and then it goes on to things like meadow cranesbills. There's a whole range of orchids that are in there, from the early purple orchid to the twayblade and the green winged and the common spotted. And it just carries, you know, then it just goes on, dyer's greenweed flowers, the knapweeds flower, and so on amongst the grasses. And then we get to this moment in August where it's just a few flowers in here, predominantly knapweed with bits of hay rattle in here with hawksbits and so on. It still looks very, very nice. But before long, we'll cut it. We'll wait for the orchids to ripen their seed and we'll cut it and we'll take all the hay away.
And so when will the orchids ripen their seed? What sort of time are we looking at for that?
Usually, second, third week of August, but it may be later this year because it's been such a cool year and such a wet year.
Well, everything's been so late this year, hasn't it?
It has, yes, it has. And, you know, look at the dyer's greenweed hasn't even ripened its seed there. So I think essentially what we're doing is that for every patch of meadow, we're waiting until the latest flowering, most important plant has ripened its seed. So if that dyer's greenweed ripens it in September, we'll wait until September before we cut it. And when we cut it right down to the ground and take all the clippings off so that the self-sowers can then, you know, can germinate and be free. And then just for diversity, Kate, we'll leave certain areas uncut, you know, like up against the hedge line or around some of these sort of habitat piles so that we again create a diversity of sward, and that becomes a safe haven for all the mammals that run into there and so on, and all the insects and so on. And then the cycle continues again, you know, so they're cut on a regular basis. Otherwise, if we didn't cut these areas, that, you know, that we'd have scrub.
Yeah.
Which is important, but not in these ornamental areas.
It's so lovely to see this on such a much bigger scale, because I've got a very small 40-foot garden, which I, you know, have as a large portion of which is meadow. And I too leave, you know, a little bit around my pond and completely uncut. So that, you know, in winter, you know, the wildlife that was using the meadow can potentially sort of, you know, knuckle on down under the scrub. And it's really important when you cut things and when you take things away, essentially, that you do make sure that any wildlife that's still using that habitat, the frogs and caterpillars and anything like that, still has a little buffer zone. So it's really lovely that you're doing that.
Yeah, I think it's just creating those different habitats. And when you look at the bigger picture, throughout the country, look at all those roadside verges that we could have as long grass areas. I don't mean those areas where you need to see oncoming traffic. Of course, cut those, because long grass next to the short grass next to long grass is important as well.
It's a good habitat.
It is. So they're having that diversity. So let's cut those areas that need us to have clear sight lines, but then leave those other areas uncut, and leave some areas to go into scrub and woodland as well. So we have that diversity rather than having to cut everything down, right down to the ground. And I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of hectares of roadside verge that can be utilized, and also there's hundreds of thousands of hectares of garden that can add up to something as well. And then there's hundreds of thousands of hectares of urban areas that can actually be significant as well. And if you add all of those up, you know, all of that stuff is outside the food production zone. You could actually make a real difference with all of those as a network going through the whole country. So, you know, it's there. It's within our reach to do something about it. But it needs, you know, it needs politicians and ecologists and conservation groups and planners, landscape architects, councils, volunteer
groups. And the will
groups,
of the people as
everybody,
well.
Everybody and the people, everybody needs to work together on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we need to do it 20 years ago, but, you know, failing that, you know, we need to start tomorrow. I just wonder how many species would be in decline if we utilised our green spaces more. And that's 22 million gardens. That's our park spaces. And like you say, all of our road verges and urban spaces. We could do so much.
Yes.
And just link everything together and make these wonderful corridors across the country.
And you know, Kate, don't you? Because you don't have to, it doesn't mean you have to turn everything into long grass.
No.
It doesn't mean you have to plant trees everywhere. It's just but taking that sort of intelligent approach to it to say, actually, that's, you know, we need to play football or throw a frisbee on that bit of grass. That's recreation. That's fine. But over there, we can have it long.
In that corner
where nobody's, you know, we can have it long. And let's train our new gardeners to actually our public realm gardeners to be aware of how to manage those spaces. Because let's just start saying to people, just because it's left long doesn't mean it's a mess. It's actually a really important habitat, you know. And actually, those wildlife areas don't need to be outside of the town and city or village in the countryside. That a lot of these things are adapted to be in sharing the ground with us. You know, let's bring everything in and just do something very effective together. And gardens will play a part in all of that. Because, you know, the other thing is this, you know, we've got this massive habitat pile in front of you, which is all these, not everybody's got space for that. You've got ancient woodlands just a few hundred yards away from that. Not everybody's got ancient woodlands. We've got big areas of bramble at the bottom of the fields there. Not everybody's got the ability to do that as well. But in our design spaces, we can do something really clever and effective that still allows people to use it. Without harming the biodiversity that's there.
So tell me more about this this habitat pile, Fergus, because this is one of my favourite parts of Great Dixter. So we're standing here, we're looking at an enormous pile of logs, really, with some nettles and teasels and hogweed growing around it, which is then surrounded by meadow and fruit trees. So tell me more about that.
Well, it all sort of came about, really, when I was... When the entomologists were walking around looking at the insects, and I got my own wood pile down at the bottom where I just cut a few bits of fallen timber that I can put into a wood burning stove. You know, I haven't done that for a while, but they found an interesting beetle on that wood pile, and they said to me, "Do you mind not burning that wood for this winter, because we need to look at what's happening with this beetle?" So that was my firewood gone for the season. So I thought, well, actually, if a beetle's making itself at home here, and it wasn't a common thing, you know, if it's making this, I want to put some more patches of dead or dying wood. And you know, we prune a lot in this garden, and we also have big trees, and they use loose limbs and so on, and we used to burn all of that, and I used to hate doing that, although everybody loves a fire, don't they? But I used to hate doing that because I never knew whether there were slow worms in there or whatever, you know. So I thought, I'm gonna build something that looks like a Romanian haystack, you know. And I had this brilliant kid who was helping me. He was trained in architecture. His name is Blaise Bavistock, and he had a really great name as well. And he had an eye for design as well. So I drew him out what I wanted, and he in turn drew out two or three options of different shapes that we could have, but this is the one that we chose. And it resembles a large haystack. It's about 20 feet across, and it was about 20 feet high, and it's got poles driven into the ground, and all the brushwood and bits of logs and whatever are just beautifully arranged right the way around it in this sort of circular pattern, and it makes a very nice architectural feature.
And you get birds nesting in there in spring, don't you?
Yes, we get birds in there, but also, you know, I think it's a safe place for hedgehogs to go where they can escape the badgers, you know, and it'll have as it rots, it'll be a good place for slow worms and grass snakes. It's got long grass around it. And of course, you know, our entomologists were really excited because they said, look, all the detritivores are in there, you know, and there's a shady side and a sunny side, and all the spiders are in there looking at going after the detritivores and so on. So it's again gives us diversity. But you can do the same sort of thing by just having a log wall, you know, putting logs on in a garden. That would do the same sort of thing.
Or an open compost heap on a much smaller scale.
Yes, it would do the same sort of thing. But they look beautiful. They look amazing.
Yeah,
I love them.
They look
slightly medieval. You know, they look like something ready for Guy Fawkes.
Yes.
You know. But I think, yes, again, it comes down to diversity. You know.
Right, where are we going next?
Well, we're just gonna take a walk down here because we're gonna go back in the garden, but I just wanna.
So we're going through a gate. We're actually leaving the garden now.
Yeah,
we're
going into the field that's just below us, and this field was grazed by sheep and it was predominantly grasses, and we turned it into a meadow, and I put these oak beams here so people can sit in it. But the interesting thing is that, you know, if you look down, there's a tree, the woods are just beyond us. And then there's this big bramble patch, this sort of edge, that woodland edge effect is really quite important. So I think and when you look out into the countryside, what you see is hedge and then woodland. Grassland areas are separate from that. There's no sort of integration of that where you've got that scrub developing. And I think that scrub layer is very important. It's a very rich part. And so again, another thing, where possible, let's allow those brambles and nettles to develop in those patches. I'm not saying in the garden, I'm not saying right next to where people are playing football or whatever, but where possible, if it allows, let them, because they're very rich areas. Because the woodland edge, which that is one of the areas that has come under pressure in throughout the countryside. And actually, when you then talk about gardens, what are gardens? They're woodland edge as well, aren't they?
Woodland edge, yeah.
Yeah, so you're creating, and if that's a very rich habitat, they call it an ecotone, I think you would know better than I do, but if that's a very rich habitat with all the native plants, imagine the woodland edge with all those exotics and the diversity of habitats that you have in a garden situation. It's the perfect storm to create something really rich.
Beautiful. And you can really see, just standing here at the top of the meadow, you can see the meadow, you can see this huge bank of brambles, and then that goes into the woodland. And you can just imagine all the different things that are living in the meadow, in the brambles, in the woodland, and how those habitats interact with each other and how the wildlife that lives among them interacts as well. It's raining quite a bit now, Fergus,
yes,
so
yeah,
I hope
know,
you're taking
yeah.
me somewhere
what a
bit
great,
drier.
What a great August, August day, eh?
It's just so amazing how on such a wet, miserable August day, the sun's barely creeping through the clouds there, that there's so much colour on that long border. All the pinks and the purples and the yellows all working together with the greens. And you wouldn't necessarily think that a really ornamental border would go hand in hand with a very wild meadow. But it does. It looks gorgeous.
And I think partly because there's that mown strip between them, so the meadow is defined.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you think in terms of a food source, the meadow hands over the baton to the border now because the meadow is going brown.
Yes.
So as the flowers dry up, the border is taken over because they're still full of flowers.
Because exotics obviously extend the season of colour.
Yes.
For us, and pollen and nectar for the for the pollinators.
Sure. I mean, but what we do is we mix natives and exotics together, you know, which is nice. I mean, you can't see the cow parsley now because it's all finished, but early on in the season, the whole thing is floating in cow parsley. In fact, that family of you know, the carrot family is very important for pollinators because there's a very nice landing pad that they can land on.
Mm.
And here you can see the bronze fennel.
And we don't tend to have many umbellifers in gardens, do we? I think they're a much overlooked type of flower in gardens. We need
they
more
look
of
wild.
Them.
That's why
they look wild.
Because they look wild and people think they're weeds. But, you know, let's go through this archway. And
so we're just heading through a beautiful yew archway now, leaving the long border, leaving those meadows behind and the ancient woodland. And what have we got up here?
Oh, yes, it's something. It's just all sort of closed in with all this vegetation. There are roses that are overflowing onto the paths, hydrangeas and flower now.
And we're actually brushing past the plants as we walk along this path, aren't we? And ducking,
yes.
Ducking under the leaves here, which is all dripping with rainwater.
And look, there's big patches of willow herb that we've left. You know,
fantastic.
You'll probably get a complaint about that in due course. But, you know, you see willow herb comes into our planting, as you can see here as well.
So despite all your credentials for helping wildlife, you still do get complaints then about letting weeds grow in your borders?
Yes, I think because people look at them as weeds. I mean, look at it. If you look at the borders now, I would say 99% of the plants are ornamental and so on. But then we do allow the odd, you know, whether it's cow parsley or willow herb or something else in there. And some people hate teasels as well. And they, you know, they're used to gardens being so much more sterile. This is a wildish garden. I mean, it's like this wild painting of colour and form, and it's very immersive. Like you just said, we have to brush through all the stuff, and that takes a bit of getting used to, you know. And some people will never get used to it, but it's just, I think it's in many ways it's joyous. But that doesn't mean that everybody has to garden like this. Everybody can. That's the beauty of it. They can all garden in different ways,
yeah.
And it will all, you know, add up to something interesting. But we still get people who complain about the meadows now because they've gone brown, and that's partly our fault because we need to really say to people, look, our grass is brown because we're waiting for the orchids on the orchid seeds to ripen. They'll ripen towards the end of August, then we'll cut all the grass. It'll look brown for a few weeks and it'll green up again. And this is the cycle of a meadow. So we just need to educate people or inform people a bit more on all of this as well. I mean, you don't get any problems when those meadows are looking extraordinary as a sort of tapestry of pinks and yellows and blues and so on, when all those orchids and things are flowering, and it just also they're humming with insects. The noise is deafening.
And that's in early summer, isn't that sort of June time?
That's June time. So it's, you know, and you don't get any complaints when it's daffodil and snakeshead fritillary and so on. It's just this moment now where they've gone brown. But we have to hold our nerve, because if we cut that meadow prematurely and didn't allow seeds to ripen, I think gradually over the years, the meadow wouldn't be as rich in flowers as it is now.
So, and also there will be caterpillars and frogs that will still be using the meadow now.
Sure, I think that's important. Yeah, it's an important habitat, isn't it?
It's an important part of the cycle. And, you know, it's a life and death thing, isn't it? I mean, things can't look that rich and beautiful in June forever.
Sure.
It has its June moment, it has its August moment. And as gardeners and as wildlife lovers, you know, and people who want to help wildlife, want to do more for diversity in our gardens, we need to accept that every month can't be June.
Yes. Yeah.
I wish that it could.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's this border called?
Well,
then,
this is a sort of a mad jumble of plants, isn't it? But this is actually a nursery stock bed.
Ah.
Where we would dig up these geraniums and split the plants and sell them down in our nursery. So all these areas that we're in now are stock beds for the nursery. And so we've got verbascums that we collect seed from, other verbascums that we take root cuttings from, salvias that we take cuttings from, geraniums that we would split, yarrows that we would split as well. So that then they get potted up and sold down at that from the bottom of the garden. And that helps to support the whole enterprise. So informal nursery areas, and you can see the production is not in straight lines, and there's nothing sterile about it as well, and they're just littered with self-sowers that are amongst them, from evening primroses to verbascums to hollyhocks to the tall white fleabane to all of those, to lithrum as well. So it looks informal and part of the garden.
It looks wild and beautiful.
Yeah. So look, we go through another archway, and we just, you know, come up to the a bedding patch that we've just changed over. These are rudbeckias that we've put in. They're going to take a bit of time to get going, but there's seeds that we've grown ourselves, and there were lichnus rosecampion here before. It's a bit of meadow beyond that. So this will give us flowers in September, October into November. Again, that prolongs the season as
well. And will you use those in the borders, or will you leave them here?
No, they'll be just left here as ornamental. And once they've finished, they're annual rudbeckias. We'll compost them and then put something else here that we're already growing from seed down in the nursery. And then you can see these topiary birds are peacocks. Well, originally they were a medley of birds, but they've all been clipped into the same shape as a peacock. So you can see how shaggy they are, because before long we'll start cutting these.
So all around us we've got these yew hedges and these yew topiaries.
Yes.
And these little peacocks dotting the landscape, really.
Yeah. So again, you could look at this and say, oh, it's so manicured and managed by humans, having these bushes put into shapes. But, you know, I don't mind that. I don't mind the formal element of Dixter. Not everything has to be wild and informal. In fact, the formal and the informal go quite well together with us, because it gives us the backbone and the structure within which we can have this sort of wildish planting.
Well, I think that's really beautiful. I think, you know, having the formal and the informal together has a really wonderful effect. Look here, I've just found a bumblebee using a teasel as an umbrella. This poor thing looks absolutely soaked.
Oh, how clever of you to see that, actually. It's perched right underneath the teasel, isn't it? That's amazing.
I mean, that's what you do, isn't it? You know, if you got caught in a rain shower, you would find the nearest thing to shelter under. And this poor bumblebee, absolutely drowned rat, she is.
Yeah.
And she's just hiding into this teasel flower.
Yeah.
Until she dries off. So where next?
So we're going to go into the high garden area, which has got sort of, again, it's got narrow borders, but beyond that, there are stock beds. And you can see there are trees surrounding, but there's just a lot of colourful dahlias and cosmos, and they're, you know, plants that everybody would grow. Hollyhocks in full flower. There's ornamental grasses as well. There's a real mixture of plants, and I think that is also important as well. And wild carrot. Look at that, just self-sown carrot, looking
gorgeous.
Absolutely gorgeous here with this lacy flowers. So I think the thing is, there is so much at Dixter. There's so much diversity. It's not just one season. It doesn't just finish with roses. You know, you could have a rose garden that you spray the living daylights out of, so it looks beautiful. But it's only one season, isn't it? This has got sort of such a long season.
And the sun's finally starting to come out, which is a very happy thing indeed.
Rather frightening for August, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there are lilies and phloxes, and see some of those sort of insects flying about already, braving the weather and flying about. And we get weeds as well. You know, we've got bindweed. We don't let it go everywhere, the bindweed, so we just pick it by hand.
As you're doing now.
Yeah, and just take it off, so just to keep on top of it. Sometimes it gets on top of us, but so we take this sort of soft approach to it.
So you don't use any weed killers or pesticides at all?
No, we don't. No, we don't. The only thing we use is we put wool around our dahlias and those sort of things, and then we'll use an organic slug pellet just once or twice. That's it. But we're even looking at squeezing that out. Other than that, there's nothing that goes onto these plants. We will use fertilizer in the garden, organic fertilizer, but not everywhere. I should think only in the bedding area. So about 10-15% of the garden gets pelleted chicken poo, for instance. You know, just a handful of that around the plant. And sometimes when we've got an old tired rose or something, we may put fish blood and bone around it, or we may, if we're planting a new shrub, we may put a bit of bone meal underneath it, but that's it, you know, not whole throughout the whole garden. So, you know, we're not organic, we're not trying to be organic, but we're just trying to do as little of that stuff as possible.
And it's working, isn't it? It's really working.
And we compost a lot. We compost everything. We're even composting our branches. The prunings that we have, if they don't go onto the habitat pile, they go onto the compost heap, and within 2 or 3 years they rotted down, and we put that back into the garden. Predominantly in the vegetable garden, we use our homemade compost. And
I love the wild look. I just love everything just looking so windswept. And
yes, and we've had certainly had the wind to sweep it. I think it's because we're this sort of large, overblown cottage garden, if you like. You know, that's just full of stuff close to the edges, to the paths, and it's this very immersive experience at Dixter. All you need, you know, a few mile an hour of wind, and it comes crashing down.
But it's good that you don't, you know, you haven't taken the plants out. You know, when things are a little bit windswept, then, you know, they you leave them, and you leave them to lean, and you leave them to, you know, look a bit messy, if you like. But I think there's beauty in that. I think it looks really wonderful.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's been that sort of year, isn't it? And if we went through a year where we didn't have as much, things would be more upright. And that's just gardening. That's the way it is. We can't even sit down on this seat, actually, Kate, because it's soaking wet. You know,
it's a very nice seat, though.
Yeah, it is. It's from our own wood. So that's another thing that we're trying to do, is use our own material as much as possible. And also we recycled old wood and things. We'll use old fence posts, reuse them again. And that in itself creates a habitat, because things bore into it and use it as a home.
Right. So here we are at the front of the house, the impressive 15th century house that everybody sees as they first enter Great Dixter.
Yes, it's a marvellous building, isn't it? It's an old building. And the fact that it's old means that there are lots of nesting places for bats and those sort of things, and all sorts of places where bees can... But even if you have a modern building, you can make it porous. Not porous to the weather, but you can make it open for all these things. You know, there's so much out there available for you to attach to your building. And I think also important that part of that planning process should involve making buildings rich for biodiversity as well. It won't cost much to do that, but it would just so that everything we build is green and as can support life.
Yeah.
You know, not just human life, but support life. And
so what have you got living in the house? Have you got birds nesting?
We've got birds nesting, we've got bats, we've got solitary bees, all sorts of things in there.
Oh, and we can see swallows flying around the house now.
Swifts, we put some swift boxes up around the back. I don't know if they've come, but we certainly are hearing swifts around. And so isn't it lovely to have a sort of a living building as well? And
a wildlife house as well, as a wildlife house garden.
And, you know, it's not, we're in East Sussex here, but you can do that throughout the world, in wherever area you are. You know, you just need that information in order to do the right thing, you know. Just so, you know, I was always, that we, ecologists and horticulturalists and architects, they should all work together in order to push forward, because it's all within our capability to do that.
Imagine if every new built house had bird boxes put in as standard.
Yes, and every bus stop had a green roof or a insect hotel, and every bike rack did the same as well, and every town and city had sustainable urban drainage systems and good planting, and along with that, all the new generation of parks people and the maintenance that we have in these towns and cities were opened, their minds were open to biodiversity and sustainability and all of that. We could, it's just about channeling our energies and our money to doing the right thing, you know, and we can do that, you know. It's all within our, it's about the way we write how these places are going to be managed and looked after. We can put it all down in the contracts as well. And there's some brilliant people out there that are doing it already, you know. John Little of the Grass Roof Company, for instance, he's doing this sort of work left, right and centre. Richard Scott up in as part of the Eden Project is doing it in Liverpool with all those extraordinary community groups are building these amazing gardens and community gardens and meeting spaces and so on as well. You know, we're a large, prestigious, historic garden, but it doesn't need to be exclusive to us. It can be for everybody to make use of this.
Yeah, you can do all of these things on a much smaller scale. Just putting a bee hotel up on your house makes your house porous. Just putting up one bird box, you know, can make a huge difference. If you put up a bird box, if your neighbours put up a bird box, we can all make a difference little by little. But using Great Dixter as an example, seeing all the amazing things you've done here, it's incredibly inspiring.
Thanks for listening to the BBC Gardeners World Magazine podcast. So, if you've enjoyed this episode, please tell others about it and rate us in your podcast provider app. And we'll see you next time.